Okay. Well, good evening. Nice to be back. Nice to be here. Like the guy said, I'm like the lightning bug that backed into the fan. I'm delighted to be here. That's an old joke, but I always like that. I never understood when anybody didn't laugh at that. That one always made me happy. We did have a delightful conference. That was a real joy to be able to do that. You know, it's fascinating. Take your Bible and turn with me to Matthew chapter 24, if you will. It's fascinating to be able to see, from my perspective, the work of the ministry as it goes on. You know, I said something to some of the folks about Brother Willard Sussums. Willard looked good. Last year when I was down here, he didn't look so good. And this year he looked so much better. Well, I only see him, you know, maybe once a year like that. So when I see him from this year to next year, it's a lot more startling to me. And he just looked how he, you know, his health has improved so much. And that's great. Well, you know, that's good. I see you guys every now and then, and that's an encouraging thing. And I'm glad to see that you're plugging along and keeping the oars in the water and the rudder going ahead. And that's an important thing, because what you do here in the work of the ministry is what the work of the ministry is about: raising up a testimony in the community to say the truth is available. Here it is, and you can have it if you'd like it. Because there are people used to say to me, "Oh, Brother Jordan, nobody believes this stuff. You know, I can't get anybody in my community to believe what I'm believing." And I said, "Well, there's got to be somebody in town as crazy as you are. You believed it. Just go find somebody like you somewhere, you know." And that's what you do. You just keep out. And if you keep on doing that, man, this is a big pulpit. Wow. Hello. Said I. Okay. Yeah, I can see. I just, you know, the guy, he's in there. I got him locked. Yeah. But, yeah, I'm not used to being able to hold on something quite this big. I got plenty of room to lay everything out here. Somebody took my picture the other day. And I was actually on the TV set in Detroit, and then they put it on Facebook, and somebody put a note, said, "Man, that's a big book in his lap." I said, "Well, yeah, I was cramming to figure out how to do Angry Birds." So you don't know what Angry Birds is, do you? I put that on my wife's iPhone, and you know, I hadn't seen her since. But anyway. Okay. Okay. Now, yeah. Oh, I got you. I've preached in barns. Somebody asked me recently, said, "What's the most interesting place you ever preached in?" And I thought a minute. I said, "You know, the most unusual place I can recall ever preaching in was standing on a fire plug preaching in the window of a pool hall." I'd gone in the pool hall and asked the guy that ran it, if I could preach, and he said, "No, we don't do that in here. We play pool and drink beer in here." So I went outside and I thought, well, I can stand on the street, but there was a window up, like, you know how they're up high, and he had it open. They had big windows, you know, glass you could see in, and I couldn't get up to it. So they had a fire plug on the corner, so I got up and stood up on the fire plug. Well, that's not easy to do. So I had a guy with me. I said, "You stand here and let me lean on you, and I'll stand here and I'll preach into the window." And I did. And in about 5 minutes, the guy came out and said, "You can't do it." I said, "A public street? I can stand here. If you don't like it, close the window." It's in Mobile, Alabama. It's a little hot, you know, and he didn't want to close the window. So he went up on the roof and took a bucket of water and dropped it down on us. Well, it didn't hit us. It splashed around us and got us wet. And then I just started saying, thank you for the cool. You know, we appreciate that. You know, if you want to cool us off again, just wait about 5 minutes so that we're warmed up again. And of course, when he dumped a bucket of water on me, I wasn't about to quit then. But my buddy, he didn't like standing on, you know, he didn't like standing there anymore. But trying to preach in the window of a pool hall, standing on a fire plug, and then getting doused with a bucket of water is probably the most odd place I ever preached. Anyway, it might not be the most interesting, but it's one of those memories that you have that you think, well, I was a kid. You do crazy things when you're young, you know, and foolhardy. I was going to just teach a little bit, and had one thing I thought I'd talk to you about, and then we can have a Q&A if you'd like to talk and just share things with you. I thought I'd teach a little bit instead of just do the Q&A. And one of the things that people are all everybody's real interested in right now is people are forecasting the end of the world in 2012. People have been forecasting the end of the world since the beginning of the world, okay? In the past, you know, there have been all kind of ancient predictions and so forth, but very little of them have been as compelling as this year's 2012 predictions that have just really dominated the interest of people. December the 21st, 2012, is supposed to be the end of the world, and it really came onto the scene a couple of years ago with the movie 2012. You know, with the Mayan calendar and all that. And John was mentioning at lunch, I think one of the greatest spoofs on that I've seen is this little cartoon where the guy, you got the Mayan guy, and he's chiseling the calendar out on a round wheel. You seen that? And he gets down, he's run out of it, he's down, no more room, and he says, somebody's going to freak out when they get to 2012. And I said, well, all in, you know, one of them that I saw was he did that, and then he had another wheel over in the corner that he hadn't got to, that you know he's going to start chiseling on next. And all of that kind of thing, you know, brings up the issue of what's going to happen this year. You know, it's supposed to be cataclysmic solar storms and the planetary alignments kind of thing, and the monstrous typhoons and the magnetic polar shifts and all the things that people are predicting that are going to happen, that are going to end civilization. In the Bible, that question was asked, Matthew 24. The Lord Jesus Christ, 2 days before he died, goes up on the Mount of Olives, Matthew 24, verse 1. Jesus went out and departed from the temple. By the way, that's a very important moment. If you notice back in chapter 23, verse 37, Matthew 23 is one of the most, one of the most negative, scathing blast of religious intolerance that you'll ever read. Jesus Christ looks at the religious, he looks at the rabbinical scholars of Israel, and he says, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. And he pronounces, woe upon you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. Woe on you, hypocrites. And he winds up calling them a generation of vipers. Verse 33, ye serpents, ye generation of vipers. I mean, he's not being real sweet to these dudes. And then in verse 37, as he's coming down looking at Jerusalem, he says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them that were sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as the hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. That's three sad words. John said it this way. He said he came into his own, and his own received him not. What a tragedy. The next verse says, but to as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believed on his name. So there were believers in Israel that did receive him. If you're not a little flock, it's your father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. But for the vast majority of the nation, They wanted nothing to do with him. And so verse 38, he says to them, "Behold, your house is left unto you desolate." It was God's house. You remember back when he cleansed the temple? He said, "You're making my Father's house a den of thieves. But now, it's your house. Is left desolate." Now watch. "For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth till you shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." And Jesus went out and departed from the temple. Literally what he's saying to them, and they got the message. This used to be my house, but I'm leaving. I'm God, and I'm leaving the temple, and I'm going to leave it desolate. Paul says in Galatians 1 that he profited in the Jews' religion above many his equal. You remember that? It became the Jews' religion, and God had left it. And Jesus Christ leaves that. He says, "You shall not see me henceforth. I'm God. I'm leaving. And what I'm leaving is going to be empty. An empty vine, an empty nation. And it's going to be that way until I come back. Because I'm God, and only I'm the one that can sit in that temple and be God." He went out and departed from the temple. And his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. They're walking out of the temple and they're not paying attention to what he's saying. They're just all staggered by the grandeur and the beauty of it. You ever been in a big, beautiful cathedral? You know, that's what they're seeing it. They're overwhelmed by it. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be torn down. It's all going to be level. Verse 15, he tells you how. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel stand in the holy place, let them which be in Judea flee to the mountains. Notice in verse 15, that's talking about the middle of the 70th week in verse 15, by the way. The temple's still going to be there. When he says that in verse number 2, all the Bible scholars, all the Bible teachers that you ever hear, they say that's a reference to 70 A.D. It's always fascinated me. I've never honestly understood why people pick up on 70 A.D. that way. They say, well, Jerusalem, the temple was destroyed. But historically, the fact is it wasn't. Israel was deported and destroyed as a nation, but the fact is they weren't. Just go get any book, go down to the Jewish synagogue close by and ask them for a history book of their history, and you'll discover that in 70 A.D., when Titus desecrated the temple, but in 115 and 135, there were two more Roman deportations, and it wasn't until 135 that they actually took them all out of the land. The Romans hated the Jews so bad, the Jews were such a thorn in their flesh, that in 135 they took them and deported them. They sowed the fields with salt, and they renamed the land of Israel, the land of Palestine, after the Philistines, the Jews' hated enemy. Did you know that the name Palestine got attached to that land by the Romans in the 2nd century? The first inhabitants of Palestine were the Jews. You say that today and people call you, you know, a political anarchist and a hateful person. Because the name Palestine has been taken, usurped, and applied to a certain group of people for political reasons. The land of Israel is the land of Palestine, the land of Israel, the land of the Middle East today. The geographical boundaries, for example, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, all the Arab Emirates over there. Have you ever looked at Saudi Arabia and wondered, why in the world would somebody have put a boundary out through the middle of the desert and done it like that? Well, that was done after the First World War, and the Brits did it because they, after the First World War, they were given control of that part of the world. And they just arbitrarily, they said, you've got to have so many square miles that belong to this tribe. And so they just went out here and go, okay, we'll give them that much. And it's all arbitrary. And when you take a name like Lebanon and stick it on a country that has a historical meaning but not historical, the boundaries of the historical country, and take a name like Palestine, and you apply it to a certain group of Arabs, when the Balfour Declaration and all the things that were doing that back in the first part of the last century, Jordan actually was designed to be the land of the Palestinians. They talk about a Palestinian state. They already had one. It's called the country of Jordan. The Jordanians threw them out, but the Jordanians are Arabs anyway. And what they did is they isolated a group of undesirables and called them Palestinians and said, what we want you to do is go take this land over here, that land. And the Jews said, wait a minute, you gave us that land. And all that stuff going on over there now is an artificial fight. It's got nothing to do with anything except the hatred that people have for one another. I often get amused. People say, boy, you know, they talk about our country, because you talk about our country because that's where we live. But if you've ever been in other countries, you know what they talk about? Their country. You know, first time I ever went outside the United States, I went to Asia, and I'd go around different Asian countries, and they'd say, how do you like our country? How do you like our country? How do you like our country? People have a natural instinct to be patriotic and love the country. Nationalism is something. You know why that is? That's the way in Genesis chapter number 8, 9, 10, and 11, God designed humanity to function. Put that in people. The things you can't understand in the world, human life, structure, if you study the Bible, you find the answers to it. The Bible is the key to things that people don't really understand about the way the world works, because the Creator, when He set the world up, tells you about how He did it in His Word. But you find people that love their country. And so it's natural for people to defend it. But you come back to the text here. The thing here is talking about not 70 AD, but verse number 3. And as He sat upon the Mount of Olives, now, immediately, and by the way, He's going to go down the rest of this chapter and all of chapter 25 and give what we call the Olivet Discourse, His discourse to His disciples from the Mount of Olives. Jesus preached two sermons on the mounts. He preached one in Matthew 5, 6, and 7 at the beginning of His ministry, where He talked about what it would be like to be a citizen of His kingdom. And then at the end of His ministry, 2 days before He dies, He goes up on the Mount of Olives again. This time goes up on the Mount of Olives. The other one wasn't on Olivet. And gives a description of His second coming, of His return. Malachi says, I'm going to return to My temple. Well, He just left the temple, chapter 23, verse 38 and 39, chapter 24, verse 1. Now He's going to talk about when He comes back. And He goes upon the Mount of Olives. Now, you remember what happened on the Mount of Olives. Look over to Acts chapter 1. Get Acts 1 in one hand and Zechariah chapter 14. Acts 1 and Zechariah 14. In Acts chapter 1, verse number 9, and when He had spoken these things, while they beheld, He was taken up, and a cloud received Him up out of their sight. While they stood steadfastly looking, while they looked steadfastly toward heaven, as He went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, which also said, ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus, which is taken up from you into heaven, shall so come in like manner as ye have seen Him go into heaven. And they returned from Jerusalem, to Jerusalem rather, from where? The mount called Olivet, which is from Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey. Where did Jesus ascend into heaven from? The Mount of Olives. See that? In like manner as you've seen Him go, He's going to come back. Well, Zechariah chapter 12, chapter 14, verse 4, if you start in verse 3, Zechariah 14, 3, then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations as when He fought in the day of battle, And his feet shall stand on that day upon where? The Mount of Olives. When Christ comes back, verse number 9, the Lord shall be king over all the earth. When he comes back to be king in the earth and set up his kingdom, the Son of Man shall come in his glory with all his holy angels with him and sit upon the throne of his glory. When he does that, the first place he touches on the ground is the last place he touched before he left. Well, that's where he goes in Matthew 24. He takes them up on that place from which he's going to go away, but more importantly, back to which he's going to return. He's setting the scene and the stage for the discussion he's going to have about his return. So everything in Matthew 24 and 25 looks toward the time when Christ is going to come back and redeem Israel and set up his kingdom. And as he, verse 24:3, as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Now, when he talks about the end of the world there, come with me, if you will, to Isaiah chapter 45. That expression, the end of the world, sometimes people get bent out of shape about their Bible because the Bible uses expressions and terminology that sometimes people don't really like. Do you get mad at the local weatherman if he tells you tonight in the weather, he said, tomorrow the sun will rise at 7:07. Today the sun sets at 6:45. Do you go, wait a minute, Jerry, where did you get your meteorologist degree? Sears? J.C. Penney's? Walmart? Don't you know that the sun doesn't rise, it's the earth that rotates, and it's the rotation of the sun that casts the shadow? What kind of meteorologist are you anyway? Now, do you get mad at him and do that, write nasty letters to the editor and call the station up and sell them? No. Why? Because we know the sun's going to rise tomorrow. Now that is a common way of describing what we perceive as happening. We're not making a meteorological declaration. But we see it happen. And we use language of accommodation. Years ago, I think the first time I can ever remember this happening to me, I was going to college in Mobile and used to, you know, between classes, you go sit in the snack shop and shoot the bull and talk to people. And we had a professor, he was a phys ed professor, and he was, you know, a phys ed professor, he's a jock, you know. And he was working on his thesis, his dissertation, to get his PhD degree. And he was, you know, I'm getting my doctorate, man. Well, when you're a PE jock, that's a pretty good thing, you know, pretty heady thing. So he was a real, like to throw his weight around intellectually. He was a dodo, but, you know, anyway, he's a jock, you get the idea. So he's sitting there talking to us, and he says, oh, the Bible, you know, the Bible's all full of mistakes. Well, I'm young, and I'm a Bible believer, and I said, well, wow, that's interesting. I've been reading the Bible. Well, I hadn't seen any of them mistakes. Would you show me a couple of them? He said, and there's somewhere it says, it talks about the four corners of the earth. Everybody, oh, no, they're not four corners of the earth. And I remember thinking, somebody better lock him up. He's dangerous. And I said to him, I said, you know, Doc, I don't know, but I was in the Boy Scouts and, we, you know, I sold Christmas cards and got me a compass, and they taught me how to navigate on the four points of the compass. You know what the word compass means? It means round, circle. Well, if you can have 4 points of a round compass, you could sure have 4 points on the earth, couldn't you? And he's looking at me like, what are you talking about? And I said, their names are north, south, east, and west. He said, oh, I was not talking about that. I said, sure it is. And I opened up the verse and showed him where the wind's going to come from the four points of the earth. I said, what do you think that is? That's north, south, east, and west. And I never forget his response. He said, my coffee's getting cold. He got up and left. He got up and left. And he didn't come back to sit with us anymore. Now, I wasn't trying to be smart, Alec, and I wasn't smart at the time. I was honestly kind of flummoxed by what he said. I look back at it now. I'm older now, and I'm willing to be a smart aleck now. I didn't have sense enough to be a smart aleck back then. I was actually kind of stunned by his unbelief. But we use those terminologies, and we talk, and we're not wrong in it. When the Bible talks about the end of the world, look at this verse. What should be the end of the world? Look at this verse, Isaiah 45:17. But Israel shall be saved in the Lord with an everlasting salvation. Ye shall not be ashamed nor confounded, world, what? Without end. Now, wait a minute. If you're going to have a world without end, how can you have the end of the world? Well, look back at chapter 23, Isaiah 23. Let me suggest something to you. Isaiah 23. Now, this context has nothing to do with what I want to talk about. I just want to read the verse and let you see a statement in the verse. Isaiah 23:17. It shall come to pass after the end of the 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre, and she shall turn to her hire and shall commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth. You've got the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth. Can you see in that verse that the word world in that verse is not talking about the planet? The planet is the earth. So when you see the word world in the Bible, it doesn't necessarily refer to the planet. Here, when he talks about the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth, the world there is the order, the organization of the affairs that are going on the planet. And we use the term world that way. We talk about the world of sports, the wide world of sports. We talk about the world of politics. You know, you're not talking about a planet. You're talking about an order and an arrangement. Sometimes we'll talk about the word world in the sense of an era, a period of time, the ancient world kind of thing. So the word world, the problem that people have with the thing about the end of the world and the world without end is they think, well, when he says world without end, he's talking about the destruction of the planet. Well, that's really not what he's talking about. He's talking about this present evil world, the arrangement of things that are under the control of Satan, being taken out from under the control. The way the affairs of the planet that take place on the planet are organized, rather than being under the control of Satan, they're going to be taken and placed under the control of the Lord Jesus Christ. So you'll have that world, and then you'll have the kingdoms of this world become the kingdoms of our Lord and His Christ, and you have the real new world order. So what they're asking about is not the destruction of the planet, but the destruction of the satanic rule over the planet. Now, the 2012 predictions about the end of the world really are like that. There are 9 different lines of thinking that have coalesced together about 2012. Started out with the Mayan calendar. You've heard about the Mayan calendar. The Mayan calendar is what's called a long count calendar. There are 3 ways to reckon time. I call it the dot, the line, and the circle. Yeah, okay. There's the moment, momentary, the now. Then there's the line. We have the now, but we have a goal, and we're going. If you're in the now, you ain't going anywhere. You're just right now. The hamster in the treadmill, he hard as he goes, he doesn't get anywhere. He's living in the now, but he's going nowhere. If you want to go from here to there, you got to have a now, and then another now, and another now. But they can't all be right here, like the hamster and treadmill. They've got to be one after another. And so you lay them out. Linear thinking. I'm here. I'm going there. I'm goal-oriented. Now, that affects the way you think about life, the way you think about society. Then there's the circular thinking. The cyclical thinking says, I'm here, I'm going there. The linear guy says, I'm here, I'm not there. This is all new. The cyclical guy says, I'm here, I'm going there, but it's not a straight line, it's a curved line, because eventually I'm going to come right back here. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, you know, in chapter 1 he says there's nothing new under the sun. What is, has been, and what shall be is. That's cyclical thinking. Now the cyclical thinking is the whole thing put together. The cultures of the world, the third world culture, you know what a third world country is? They call it undeveloped world and stuff. It really isn't based on the industrialization issue. It really is that in the third world, people think in this now thinking, the eternal present. If you think in the eternal present, I have a book. I'm enjoying the book, reading the book. I lay it down, and then I go over here, and he sees the book, and he picks up the book. Okay? Now, who owns the book? Well, he does. But I owned it a minute ago because I had it. But now he owns it because now he has it. And the only issue is in that there's no way really to establish consistent property rights in that. But now if you're linear thinking, there's the book. I pick up the book. The book's mine. I bought it, paid for it, it's mine. Keep your hands off my book. And if I go over here, you know what? That's still my book. Why? Because we don't live in the now. We develop the right to own something, and whether I'm here or there, I own it. And so the Western world, the industrialized world, works on that basis. I'm here, I'm going somewhere. I'm not a hamster in a cage running a treadmill. I'm moving along, and I'm building on things. Each step I build on something, I'm building. That's the linear. You ever heard anybody say, this world keeps going on the way it's going to go, we're all going to go to hell in a handbasket? But did you notice it never does? We never get to hell in a handbasket? You know why? Because it never goes the way it was going to go. Because the line doesn't go straight, the line bends. Now, socially, the reason it bends is because, have you noticed, if you've got children, you know this. This is why you love grandchildren. Because a child, if the parents say, left, you know what the child will say? Right. Every generation goes the opposite of the previous generation. It's sort of the yin and the yang of life. That's what they're describing when they describe the yin and the yang. You can't walk if you don't. And when you walk, you push back and forth against each other. Now, if you're here, Grandpa, and your kid goes there against you, where do your grandkids go? They back over there with you. I talked to Teresa Sessoms. I can't tell you her. I knew Teresa before she was married. That's the Sussum's daughter. We were talking at the conference, and my wife stayed home because she's attended our grandkids, and grandkids trump Bible conferences right off the bat. They trump husbands. They trump everything. And she laughed. She said, yep. She says, you know, it's almost like we, the parents, don't exist. I said, yep, you're right. But see, why that is here's a grandparent, kid, fight, no. Grandkids, oh, they got me. But you know what happens? With that natural, each generation kind of moves, it bends the line. Then their kids come and they bend the line. Their kids come, and you know what? The natural cycle of the way God set up human life, a nation, to run on a cyclical pattern, Genesis 8. What that means is that every so often, you kind of cycle back to where you are now. We're in the wintertime. What do you expect when the winter hits? Yeah, you don't expect to be harvesting corn. You do that in the fall. How do you know what winter's going to be like? Did you look at fall? No. Do you look at spring? You look at the what? Last winter. You got to go back to the last cycle when you were where you are. That's why political pundits and religious prognosticators always screw things up, because they look lineally, take the now, project it forever into the future, and they fail to see the cycle. If you want to understand where you are in your life, I turned 64 last month. If I want to understand what it's like at this stage of my life, you know what I look at? I don't look at like when I was 20 or 30 or 40. I look at like when some of you moved into your 60s. And as you move on the horizon, I keep watching what it's going to be. Kind of discouraging. You know, for some of you, kind of discouraging to us. But you... The Mayans lived in a... The genius of the Mayans was they lived in a world that was basically in the now cycle. But they lived there with the thinking of the long... The Mayan long calendar was a cyclical calendar. That's the reason I'm going through this. It was a calendar that understood the cyclical form of life. Now, by the way, if the third world thinks in this instant, and the West thinks in the lineal, it's the East that thinks in the cyclical. If you go into the Eastern culture and they worship their ancestors, that kind of thing, that's where that comes from, because that's where they get reincarnation from, because we're always bringing the past into the present, into the past, and it's always just a cycle. The problem is they get like the hamster, where they got the big cycle with the hamster going nowhere. So if you don't have all three of them, you wind up going nowhere. Okay? The Mayans had this understanding of the cyclical pattern of history. And what they did is they, and by the way, in Mayan culture, 13, the number 13 was very important to them. That's an important Bible number in certain ways. But what they did is they developed this calendar, and what happened in 2012 is that one of the long cycles comes to a conclusion. Now, when that long cycle comes to a conclusion, they don't think the world, the universe is going to go away. They just think that cycle is over. What comes in 2013? The beginning of the next cycle. If you go to that piano keyboard, how many notes are on a piano keyboard? There are 88 keys on a piano keyboard, but there are only seven notes. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. What's next? A. That eighth note is an octave up from the first. It's a new beginning. I know you got the black notes and stuff in there, and the diastolic and trist. You know, I understand the scale stuff, but the half steps and the steps and all that. But my point to you is that when you get to that eighth note, you get up that octave, what did you do? You didn't start. You just started over again. So what the Mayan calendar was about has nothing to do with the destruction of the piano or the music or the world. It just had to do with this cycle that we've been in for 5,900 years in their calendar or whatever it was, now we're going to start again. And the Mayans never believed, never taught that the world, the universe, is going to be destroyed. They taught simply that that's when the next long cycle began. You follow that? Now, when you see that, you study that, you know that, you say, well, what's all this hype? Where'd all that come from? Now, it's a myth. The Mayans never believed that at all. By the way, a long cycle for a Mayan, these recurring long cycle, they went on the lunar year, 360 days, they called it a tun, T-U-N, tune. You take 20 tunes and you got an egra. You take 20 egras, you got a katun, and you take 20 katuns and you got a batun. Well, if you got a batun, you really got 400 tunes, or you got 395 years. Well, when you get 13 of them, 13 batuns, then you've got a whole cycle. So you multiply 395 by 13, and you got how long that cycle is, and that got them from someplace back here to 2012. That's all. December 21st, why would they pick December 21st? Because that's the winter. Yeah. Okay. So you say, oh, all right, well, Now what about that, Brother Rick? What about the alignment of the stars, the galactic alignment? The galactic alignment is when the astronomical alignment of the sun and the earth with the center of our galaxy, the center of the Milky Way. And in December, the sun, the earth, and the center of the galaxy are going to be in a straight line. The statement is that on the morning of the 21st of December, as the sun comes across the horizon, the sun, the earth, and the center of the Milky Way are going to be in a straight line. Now, instantly, you know the problem with that, don't you? We're in the Eastern time zone. You know what time it is where I live in Chicago? Well, it's 6 o'clock here. It's 5 o'clock there. Central time zone. You go where my son is in Arizona, and it's 4 o'clock, he's in the mountain. You got where Brother John Verstegen is in Pennsylvania, in California, and it's 3 o'clock because he's Pacific. So, when the sun comes across the horizon here at 7 o'clock in the morning, it isn't going to be up in Chicago yet. You see the problem? When the sun comes across the Earth's horizon and December 21st, where? Which horizon? What part of the earth? And by the way, that's just a matter of perception anyway. So you see, that's a hoax. You know it's a hoax because it's based on perception that you have no way of nailing down where. It's an illusion. It's a myth. By the way, in 2000, Mars, Saturn, Mercury, and Venus were all in a line with one another within 50 degrees. They're all lined up. You know what happened? On one side of the sun here. You know what happened? Nothing. June the 13th of 2010, Uranus, Jupiter, Mercury on one side, Venus, Mars, and Saturn lined up, Sun in the middle. You know what happened? Nothing, honey. You'd have been better having nut and honey for breakfast than worrying about that, because nothing happened. You see, the planetary alignments with the center of the universe, it's no big deal. By the way, every year in December, the Earth, the Sun, and the center of the Milky Way in the constellation of Sagittarius line up. Every year. You know what happens every year? Ain't no big deal. But boy, it sounded good, didn't it? Because we got these Mayans say, man. And the 21st, well, that's that sun earth stuff, you know, and boy, that's when they... Somebody says, well, Brother Rick, didn't Nostradamus talk about this? You know who Nostradamus is? You guys remember Gene Dixon? Most of you old enough to remember old Gene Dixon, you know. She was the early version of the psychic hotline. Well, Nostradamus was the original back in the 1500s. He was a French astrologer, star worshiper, and psychic. Napoleon said about some of Nostradamus' predictions, a quote, people say Napoleon said this, I'll take their word for it. I like what he said. He said, in regard to Nostradamus, people are willing to believe anything as long as it's not written in the Bible. Well, Nostradamus is supposed to have predicted some things about 2012. Let me read you, illustrate to you about Nostradamus. I want to read to you his most famous oracle, his most famous prediction. The young lion will overcome the old one on the field of war in a single combat. He will burst his eye in the cage of gold. Two fleets won, then to die a cruel death. Now, man, that's a blessing, isn't it? I need a little Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic to understand this one. That, he said, was a reference to the death of King Henry, the King of France, Henry II, who was wounded in a jousting contest in 1557 and died 10 days later. Now think about it. The young lion will overcome the old lion. The guy that King Henry was jousting with was 6 years younger than King Henry. I don't know about you, but if you're 6 years younger than me, I don't think I'm an old lion taking a young lion down. I think it's just two old dudes rolling around on the ground. So that don't fit very well. On the field of war in a single combat, King Henry was killed, not on the field, in the field of war, no war involved. He was in a jousting contest, a sporting event. You know what jousting was? A sporting event. He was like, you know, you say, why would anybody do that? Why would people play hockey? My church in Chicago, we every week, sometime twice a week, we put two full hockey teams on the ice and have a bench. That's the stupidest thing I ever heard of. Alex Kerr, the other pastor, he's 50 years old. He's out there playing hockey. Another guy, he's older than I am. He's out there playing. In fact, he ring leads the thing, goes and rents the ring and does the thing. He's playing hockey. We got young guys, 15, 18 years old. They just look like the wind. Oh, Bob DeCart, you guys don't know Bob, but he's our engineer. Just he's Dilbert. You know who Dilbert was or is in the cartoon? Bob is a he, he's a computer nerd. He's a programmer. He's a brilliant guy. Doesn't have a practical sense much. I love you, Bob, but when you hear this. He's going to go play hockey. You know, you watch these young guys do it a while, and you got, I got to go prove my manhood, you know. He gets this, goes out, gets a, they go spend hundreds of dollars buy all this stupid gear. You know, he's got his helmet, he's out there. And he's out there, and he's, and they flip him the puck. So he stops it, he's got it, and he looks up, and here comes a 20-year-old at him. Going to take that puck. You know what I'd have done? I'd just shoved it right out there and let him have it. Bob froze. And that guy cold cocked him. Forearm right in the chest. Down he went. Bang. I'm standing there watching. I'm going, oh, Bob. Bang. He hit the ground. Well, what do you do? A man, when he hits the ground, what's the first thing he wants to do? Get up. So, Bob, he's getting up. He got up. And it was just like in the comics. He got up, his feet he's on ice skates now. His feet start going, and this time he's down again. This time I'm watching his head rattle in his helmet. He's out cold. He doesn't know where he's at. He was dinged real good the first time, rattled. Second time, old Bob's in, he's got the birds flying around. That crazy fool is out there every week still. I said, I'm not going to go to watch you. I never ice skated, so I'm not doing it. I said, I'm not going to go watch. I'll kill yourself anymore. You know, when you need the funeral, call me. You're in the hospital. Just. But it's a sport. It's stupid. It's dangerous. But it's a sport. They love each other. They love jousting. Was that Henry and this dude were friends. They weren't enemies. And they were jousting. And there was an accident. And a splinter off the lance pierced King Henry's skull. He would burst his eye in the cage of. It didn't burst his eye. Nothing happened to his eye. No battle. The facts about Henry II's death have nothing to do with what Nostradamus said. Two years before this, Nostradamus said about King Henry that he was the most invincible. Well, okay, Nost, which is he? The most invincible, or are you going to kill him? You take Bible prophecy. You know what Bible prophecy does? It says 700 years before he's born, here's the town he's going to be born in. Here's the medically impossible mother that he's going to have. There's the cross he's going to die on. There's the grave they're going to put him in. There's the people going to be on either side of the grave. Here's how he's going to come down off the mountain and present himself as king in Jerusalem. He gives you specific, historically validatable, identifiable prediction. Not this vague, phony stuff. Nostradamus was a phony. He never said anything not only that you could believe, but that you could understand. Somebody says, "Well, Brother Rick, what about that brewery, Planet X? What about that planet, that 12th planet that's circling around the Earth? Takes that 3,600-year, orbit that goes out. You know, Pluto got demoted. But you got this non-existent Planet X, and it's supposed to come in 2012 in December and be down here making this loop around the Earth. And when it does, it's going to shift the magnetic poles. Now, the first problem with that is there's no historical evidence that there is a Planet X. Number two, if there is, and it's going to be here by December, you know what? It's got to be closer than Pluto. About half of Pluto's 5 billion kilometers away. It'd have to be about half that to get here. Pluto's the smallest of the planets, not a planet anymore because it's so small, but you can still see them very easily. Come to Chicago, the planet, Admiral Planetarium, you can see it with a telescope. You examine the heavens, and you know where you see planet X? It ain't there. Well, a planet that ain't there that's supposed to be here in December, you know what's going to happen in December? He ain't showing up. So all this vaunted evidence begins to be, wait a minute, it's not good. Well, Brother Rick, what about if planet X came and the polar, don't you know that NASA agrees that the poles are shifting? You've got North Pole, South Pole, positive, negative. The core of the Earth is a magnetic, this magnetic charge there, and it's shifting. I know they say it's shifting, but you know they only say it shifts just a little bit, and it doesn't shift fast, it shifts slowly. But even if it shifted overnight, you know what it would be? It would still be there, and it would still be providing the magnetic shield for the Earth against the cosmic interference. So even if it turned over, the only thing that happens is that we'd have to stand on our head to read the clock. Oh, okay. Turn your compass around. Most of us can't get around with them anyway. But see, even if it, you take the worst case, the bottom line is it still would be a planetary magnetic field, and it's still going to protect us from the space radiation that people are afraid of. So I look at all that and I think, gee, man. Oh, by the way, the two that I love the most, one is alien rescue. Going to be an alien, an alien invasion in 2012. Did you see the movie Expelled that Ben Stein did a couple of years ago? Well, if you didn't see that, you ought to rent, go to the library and rent that. I was down at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and he was there previewing it. I'm going to go to that meeting again, that convention again in February. We go about every 4 years because it's like a trade show for the industry, and you learn a lot of stuff. This year we're going to buy some equipment for the TV program, cameras and recording equipment, so you go to where you can see everything in a room, you know. So we went a couple of years ago, did some of that. He was previewing this movie. Expelled is a movie about how he discovered, Ben Stein is a Jew, not a believer, not a Christian, but he said, I was raised as a Jew believing there's a God. Believing there's a creator. He said, I didn't know much about him, but I knew there's a creation. Here we are, and I knew there had to be a creator. And then he discovered by accident, talking to some people, that if you tried to teach intelligent design as opposed to evolution in the government schools, you'd get kicked out. And he met a guy who was a professor who had lost his tenured professorship because he believed in intelligent design. And what Expelled is about how you can't teach intelligent design in the government schools anymore. So he did this big, long documentary about it, and one of the things he did is he went and talked to some of the world's leading scientists. Two of them, one of them that you've heard of, Richard Dawkins, the big atheist guy, and he's asking him, he says, well, where do you think life came from? You know, if it evolved, well, where did it come from? And Dawkins, in a jaw-dropping, hush-causing answer, he shrugs, he says, well, my best guess would be alien seeding. That aliens came and seeded the human life, that humans came from the seeding of aliens. Well, Ben asked him, he says, but where'd the aliens come from? How'd that help? Which is, you know, you got to have a first cause. If you believe anything's real, where'd it come from? And I'm thinking, here's this recognized intellectual guru, the Carl Sagan of the 21st century, aliens. Then I read about 2012, and that same crowd is saying, well, This is the year when the aliens are going to come back and rescue us from ourselves and bring enlightenment. And I think, okay. Next question. Sometime you can be educated beyond your ability to handle it. My other favorite argument was, it's called a web bot. You know what a web bot is? It's a robot designed to work on the internet. And the web bot project was something that was done back in the late 90s. They developed a web program, computer program, to reach out with and examine, find on the internet. You know how the you hear about the government checking the chatter on the internet, that kind of stuff? To reach out and to use as a filter 300,000 emotionally based words. That would be more than English, but it's all the languages. And based upon the use of those emotionally based words, at any moment they could get a snapshot of the consciousness of humanity. What is mankind think? Not an individual, but just the collective thinking of people. What is the attitude that people have? And on the basis of that, they were going to trade 30, 60, 90 days in the stock market. And it actually worked about 60% of the time with the stock market. Then they reached out and took it and applied it to the country. And they actually say they predicted 9/11. The problem is that's the only prediction they've had outside of stock market stuff that worked out. And a couple of years later, they were predicting an earthquake and a tidal wave hit Seattle. And, of course, that didn't happen. But they've predicted with the web bot that in 2012 there would be earthquakes and some minor nuclear weapon exchanges. And I think, wow, you know, the web bot project, that's going to be a real, we're tapping the collective. The problem I have with that is if you tap the collective thinking of people and the thinking is erroneous to start with. For example, the hallucination of Nostradamus and the myth of the Mayan calendar and the bad science of the planet alignments. If that's permeating the thinking, what's the conclusion the web bot's going to have? It's going to be bad. It's going to be error. It's going to be bad. So that isn't going to help either. So I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking, well, all this stuff's based on myth and lies and bad science. But there really is going to be an end to the world. You understand that? There really will be. The 2012 prophecy and predictions of the end of the world are just unreliable. If you'll let your eye run down through Matthew 24 and just let it run down through that chapter, see if you find 2012 mentioned in that chapter anywhere. It's not. But look at verse 36. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. So the one time I know that it isn't going to be is when somebody says it is. Because God said you can't know. But you know, the world will end. You don't know when, but you know it's going to happen. But there is one place in the Bible where 2012 is aligned with Bible prophecy. I call it Apocalypse 2012. There's a book in the Bible called the Apocalypse. The word means apocalypso is the word unveiling. It's the book of the Revelation. So come to look at Revelation chapter number 20, verse number 12. Here's the 2012 in the Bible that you need to remember. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God. And the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. You know what? The end of the world is going to happen. And the dead, small and great, are going to stand before God and give account. Now, the dead in that verse are the lost dead. If you go back to verse number 4, and I saw thrones, and they that sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them, and I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither the mark, had received his mark upon their foreheads and in their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead, you've got the righteous resurrected now. The rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. On such the second death hath no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Notice in verse 6 that blessed is he that hath part in the first resurrection. The first resurrection has parts to it. The first installment of the first resurrection, the first part, is the rapture, the resurrection of the members of the body of Christ. Christ descends from heaven with a shout, the voice of the archangel, the dead in Christ are raised first. We which are alive and remain are caught up together to meet them in the clouds, to meet them to go to be with the Lord. That's the one you're going to be in if you're saved. I'm assuming you are. After that, all the saints from Adam to the second advent of Christ, what we call the Old Testament saints, are going to be resurrected. That's what he's talking about there. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Jesus said, will come and sit together in the kingdom. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob didn't live together. For them to sit together, well, they got to be resurrected. You go back over in Psalms in the 90s, in those hymn psalms, and he's got Moses and Samuel marching into the kingdom together. Well, Mo and Sam didn't live together. The only way they can march together, resurrect. Old Testament saints. He told Daniel, at the end of the days, you'll stand in your lot. The Old Testament saints, at the beginning of the millennium, all of the righteous have been resurrected. The only people left to stand before God are lost people. And 2012 tells you what's going to happen to them. They're going to stand before God, and they're going to be judged. And verse 14 said, the death and hell shall be cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. Can I tell you that people you know and love are going to be in that? That's a tragedy. There will come an end to the world as we know it. And the kingdoms of this world will be taken from the power of darkness and translated and placed under the authority of God's own Son. You know what I'd suggest to you in 2012? Remember that 2012. You ought to make this year a year where in your life there is a priority above everything else about getting the gospel to people you know that are lost. You ought to make it a priority, evangelism a priority. You ought to sit down tonight before the Lord and say, Lord, I'm going to make it a personal commitment to personally, me, being involved in winning someone to Jesus Christ this year. Now, you might not wind up being somebody that goes out and wins 10, 15, 20,000 people a year to Jesus. But some of you have never won anybody in your whole life. One of the great things about being a part of a local church is that somebody who has a certain strength in one area, I can be a part of a ministry where I don't have that strength, but I can work with them that do, and I can get the fruit from that. Someone else has got an ability in another area. We can work together and get the benefit of them, support them so they can do it. So as an assembly, I challenge you, make this year. Listen, I know you guys as an assembly have been through some knocks. It's time for you to get your mind and your focus and your priority where God's is. God's priority is not in our failures. God's priority is in what He's doing in His Son. The will of God is that all men be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. So what should your priority be? And it won't be that. It won't be that for you personally. It won't be that for you as an assembly unless you make the commitment to make it that. And the assembly can't have that commitment until you personally do it. I ran across a statistic recently that just blew my mind. And I verified this in three or four different ways, and it seems to be true. Have you ever heard of the 80-20 rule? Well, there's some research was done at the university, at MIT, really, the Technical Institute, about a group of people and how many people in a group it takes to move that group from point A to point B, from one view to another view. And they've concluded, and this I'm talking about secular things now, that if you have 10% of a group thoroughly committed to an idea, the group will move to that idea. All it takes is 10% to be all in. That's 1 out of 10. 10 out of 100. It doesn't take the whole group. You're never going to get the whole group. It just takes 10%. Now, if that's true in secular things, you want to move a corporation? You want to move a culture? Think of the great changes that have taken place in our society. It's always been that little small group of thoroughly committed, totally won't be denied people. And when I looked at that, thought about that, I thought, wow, you know, 10% is doable. But it has to start with somebody. If you make the choice, personally, I'm going to see someone come to know Christ this year. And start where you are. Somebody came to me at the conference yesterday and said, I need to know how to share the gospel. Here's some training material. Get trained. I've told people for years. People say, we don't have a Grace Church. I said, go outside in your front yard, turn around and look at your house, read the address, and there's the address. Look how far ahead of that you are. You got all these people, seats, chairs, your history. You're ahead of that. Somebody did it, thought about it. You make the commitment. family in our assembly recently bought a new home, another home. I was talking to him, I said, you had a perfectly lovely home. Why did you make this move? He said, because we want our home, we want to use our home for ministry. And the home we had wasn't conducive to the hospitality necessary to do the work of the ministry. And I said, bless your heart, buddy. Tell me when you're going to be open. I'll send some people. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, when Paul talks about a widow who's to be honored and brought into the assembly, did you ever wonder what ladies ought to do in the work of the ministry? People argue about should they teach it. Paul, Philippians 4, talks about the women that labored with me in the gospel. One of the keys to the expansion of the gospel in the first 3 centuries of Christianity, where it expanded all over the world, spontaneously, without any organization, one of the keys was the participation of the women in the assembly. And without the women's full participation in the assembly, it would not have happened. But then what were they doing? They weren't pastors. They weren't teaching. What were they doing? It's not their role to teach doctrine. What were they doing? Well, you go read it in 1 Timothy chapter 5. One of it was they were talking about hospitality. You know what? They're the social glue that puts it together. You know what guys do? You live in a house, you would never put a picture on the wall. Why would you put a hole in the wall? A curtain. Why would I need a curtain? You know, I can't see out. A chair. I moved to Florida to go to school. I rented a little house. I knew something I was going to get married. I found a little house and rented the house. And I went to the Goodwill store, bought a chair like Dwayne's got back there for me to sit in. I went and bought a rollaway bed for me to sleep in. And I had a couple of boxes to put my clothes in. And I had a plate and a glass and a knife and fork. And my mom had given me a 8-plate setting, you know. But I'm only one guy, I only need one. And I lived there for a couple of months. That's all I had in the house. I was happy as a bug in a rug. My dad came by one day, looked at the place, had a fit, went home, told my mother. 2 weeks later, here they come with a trailer load of furniture and you can't live like this. And next thing I know, there's curtains on the windows and there's sheets on the bed and there's new bed in here and there's houses full of junk. And it became a home. So when Cynthia and I got married, there wasn't much to do. It was already done. Guys don't think that way. Well reported of for good works. She hath brought up children. She hath lodged strangers. She's washed the saints' feet. She's relieved the afflicted. If she give diligent and follow. You know what she's doing? She's creating an environment of warmth in which the gospel can grow. It can reach out to people. That you can take someone from the cold of the world and put them in and see them thaw. If you would make this year the year that you're going to give yourself your home to remembering the people you know that you love are going to face God one day, you need to commit yourself to using your home. I'm talking to you right down on the shelf where life is now. I'm talking about being fully engaged, getting personally involved. Then if your elders and preacher don't get on the ball, go kick them in the seat and say, hey, come on, we're going. It's not them trying.